Meantime, in Rome, Mussolini's hopes were being smashed. At 2 p.m., Ciano received the British and French ambassadors and, in their presence, telephoned to both Halifax and Bonnet and informed them of Attolico's talks with the German foreign minister. Bonnet was effusive as usual and, according to his own account in the French Yellow Book, warmly thanked Ciano for his efforts on behalf of peace. Halifax was sterner. He confirmed that the British note was not an ultimatum. One marvels at the splitting of hairs among the statesmen over a single word, for the Anglo-French declarations spoke for themselves unequivocally, but added that in his own view the British could not accept Mussolini's proposal for a conference unless the German armies withdrew from Poland, a matter on which Bonnet again was silent. Halifax promised to telephone Ciano the decision of the British cabinet on that. The decision came shortly after 7 p.m. Britain accepted the Duce's offer on condition that Hitler pull back his troops to the German frontier. The Italian foreign minister realized that Hitler would never accept this and that nothing more could be done, as he put it in his diary. "It isn't my business," he added, "to give Hitler advice that he would reject decisively and maybe with contempt. I tell this to Halifax, to the two ambassadors, and to the Duce. And finally, I telephone to Berlin that unless the Germans advise us to the contrary, we shall let the conversations lapse. The last note of hope has died." And so, at 8:50 p.m. on September 2nd, the weary and crushed Attolico once more made his way to the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin. This time Ribbentrop received him in the Chancellery, where he was in conference with Hitler. A captured Foreign Office memo records the scene. The Italian ambassador brought the foreign minister the information that the British were not prepared to enter into negotiations on the basis of the Italian proposal of mediation. The British demanded, before starting negotiations, the immediate withdrawal of all German troops from the occupied Polish areas and from Danzig. In conclusion, the Italian ambassador stated that the Duce now considered his mediation proposal as no longer in being. The foreign minister received the communication from the Italian ambassador without comment. Not a word of thanks to the tireless Attolico for all his efforts. Only the contempt of silence toward an ally who was trying to cheat Germany of its Polish spoils. The last slight possibility of averting World War II had now been exhausted. This apparently was obvious to all except one actor in the drama. At 9 p.m., the pusillanimous Bonnet telephoned Ciano, confirmed once more that the French note to Germany did not have the character of an ultimatum, and reiterated that the French government was prepared to wait until noon of September 3rd, the next day, for a German response. However, in order for the conference to achieve favorable results, Bonnet told Ciano, the French government agreed with the British that German troops must evacuate Poland. This was the first time Bonnet had mentioned this, and now only because the British had insisted upon it. Ciano replied that he did not think the Reich government would accept this condition, but Bonnet would not give up. He sought during the night a final escape from France's obligations to the now battered and beleaguered Poland. Ciano recounts this bizarre move in the first paragraph of his diary entry for September 3rd. "During the night I was awakened by the ministry because Bonnet had asked Guariglia, the Italian ambassador in Paris, if we could not at least obtain a symbolic withdrawal of German forces from Poland. I throw the proposal in the wastebasket without informing the Duce, but this shows that France is moving toward the great test without enthusiasm and full of uncertainty." The Polish War becomes World War II. Sunday, September 3rd, 1939, in Berlin, was a lovely end-of-the-summer day. The sun was shining, the air was balmy. The sort of day, I noted in my diary, the Berliner loves to spend in the woods or on the lakes nearby. As it dawned, a telegram arrived at the British Embassy from Lord Halifax for Sir Neville Henderson, instructing him to seek an interview with the German Foreign Minister at 9 a.m. and convey a communication, the text of which was then given. The Chamberlain government had reached the end of the road. Some 32 hours before, it had informed Hitler that unless Germany withdrew its troops from Poland, Britain would go to war. There had been no answer, and now the British government was determined to make good its word. On the previous day, it had feared, as Charles Corbin, the French ambassador in London, had informed the hesitant Bonnet at 2:30 p.m., that Hitler was deliberately delaying his reply in order to grab as much Polish territory as possible. after which, having secured Danzig, the corridor, and other areas, he might make a magnanimous peace proposal based on his 16 points of August 31st. To avoid that trap, Halifax had proposed to the French that unless the German government gave a favorable reply within a few hours to the Anglo-French communications of September 1st, the two Western nations should declare themselves at war with Germany. Following a British cabinet meeting on the afternoon of September 2nd, when a definite decision was made, Halifax suggested specifically that the two allies present an ultimatum to Berlin that very midnight, which would expire at 6 a.m. on September 3rd. Bonnet would not hear of any such precipitate action. Indeed, the badly divided French cabinet had had a difficult time over the past week reaching a decision to honor France's obligations to Poland, and to Britain, in the first place. On the dark day of August 23rd, overwhelmed by the news that Ribbentrop had arrived in Moscow to conclude a Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact, Bonnet had persuaded Daladier to call a meeting of the Council of National Defense to consider what France should do. The minutes of the meeting, drawn up by General de Camp, chief of Premier Daladier's military cabinet, came to light at the Riom trial. The paper was never submitted to other members of the meeting for correction, and General Gamelin, in his book Servir, claims it was so abbreviated as to be misleading. Still, even the timid generalissimo confirms its main outlines. Besides Premier Daladier and Bonnet, it was attended by the ministers of the three armed services, General Gamelin, the chiefs of the Navy and Air Force, and four additional generals, 12 in all. The minutes state that Daladier posed three questions. 1. Can France remain inactive while Poland and Romania, or one of them, are being wiped off the map of Europe? 2. What means has she of opposing it? 3. What measures should be taken now? Bonnet himself, after explaining the grave turn of events, posed a question which was to remain uppermost in his mind to the last. Taking stock of the situation, had we better remain faithful to our engagements and enter the war forthwith? Or should we reconsider our attitude and profit by the respite thus gained? The answer to this question is essentially of a military character. When thus handed the ball, Gamelin and Admiral Darlan answered that the army and navy were ready. In the early stages of the conflict, they can do little against Germany, but the French mobilization by itself would bring some relief to Poland by tying down some considerable German units at our frontier. General Gamelin, asked how long Poland and Romania could resist, says that he believes Poland would honorably resist, which would prevent the bulk of the German forces from turning against France before next spring. By then, Great Britain would be by her side. In his book, Servir, Gamelin admits that he hesitated to call attention to some of France's military weaknesses because he did not trust Bonnet. He quotes Daladier as later telling him, "You did right. If you had exposed them, the Germans would have known about them the next day." Gamelin also claimed, in his book, that he did point out at this conference the weakness of France's military position. He says he explained that if Germany annihilated Poland, and then threw her whole weight against the French, France would be in a difficult situation. In this case, he said, it would no longer be possible for France to enter upon the struggle. By spring, with the help of British troops and American equipment, I hoped we should be in a position to fight a defensive battle, of course if necessary. I added that we could not hope for victory except in a long war. It had always been my opinion that we should not be able to assume the offensive in less than about 2 years, that is, in 1941-42. The French generalissimo's timid views explain a good deal of subsequent history. After a great deal of talk, the French finally reached a decision, which was duly recorded in the minutes of the meeting. In the course of the discussion, it is pointed out that if we are stronger a few months hence, Germany will have gained even more, for she will have the Polish and Romanian resources at her disposal. Therefore, France has no choice. The only solution is to adhere to our engagements to Poland, assumed before negotiations were started with the USSR. Having made up its mind, the French government began to act. Following this meeting on August 23rd, the Alerte was sounded, which placed all frontier troops in their war stations. The next day, 360,000 reservists were called up. On August 31st, the cabinet published a communique saying France would firmly fulfill its obligations. And the next day, the first day of the German attack on Poland, Bonnet was persuaded by Halifax to associate France with Britain in the warning to Berlin that both countries would honor their word to their ally. But on September 2nd, when the British pressed for an ultimatum to be presented to Hitler at midnight, General Gamelin and the French general staff held back. After all, it was the French who alone would have to do the fighting if the Germans immediately attacked in the west. There would not be a single British trooper to aid them. The general staff insisted on a further 48 hours in which to carry out the general mobilization unhindered. At 6 p.m., Halifax telephoned Sir Eric Phipps, the British ambassador in Paris. 48 hours is impossible for British government. The French attitude is very embarrassing to His Majesty's government. It was to become dangerously so a couple of hours later when Chamberlain rose to address a House of Commons whose majority of members, regardless of party, was impatient at the British delay in honoring its obligations. Their patience became almost exhausted after the Prime Minister spoke. He informed the House that no reply had yet come from Berlin. Unless it did and contained a German assurance of withdrawal from Poland, the government would be bound to take action. If the Germans did agree to withdraw, the British government, he said, would be willing to regard the position as being the same as it was before the German forces crossed the Polish frontier. In the meantime, he said, the government was in communication with France about a time limit to their warning to Germany. After 39 hours of war in Poland, the House of Commons was in no mood for such dilatory tactics. A smell of Munich seemed to emanate from the government bench. "Speak for England," cried Leopold Amory from the conservative benches, as the acting leader of the Labour opposition, Arthur Greenwood, got up to talk. "I wonder how long we are prepared to vacillate," said Greenwood, "at a time when Britain and all that Britain stands for and human civilization are in peril. We must march with the French." That was the trouble. It was proving difficult at this moment to get the French to march. But so disturbed was Chamberlain at the angry mood of the House that he intervened in the sharp debate to plead that it took time to synchronize thoughts and actions by telephone with Paris. "I should be horrified if the House thought for one moment," he added, "that the statement that I have made to them betrayed the slightest weakening either of this government or of the French government." He said he understood the French government was in session at this moment, and that a communication would be received from it in the next few hours. At any rate, he tried to assure the aroused members, "I anticipate that there is only one answer I shall be able to give the House tomorrow, and I trust the House will believe me that I speak in complete good faith." The inexorable approach of the greatest ordeal in British history was announced, as Namier later wrote, in a singularly halting manner. Chamberlain well understood, as the confidential British papers make clear, that he was in deep trouble with his own people, and that at this critical moment for his country, his own government was in danger of being overthrown. As soon as he left the Commons, he rang up de Laudier. The time is recorded as 9:50 p.m., and Cadogan, listening in, made a minute of it for the record. Chamberlain: "The situation here is very grave. There has been an angry scene in the House. If France were to insist on 48 hours to run from midday tomorrow, it would be impossible for the government to hold the situation here. The Prime Minister said he quite realized that it is France who must bear the burden of a German attack, but he was convinced some step must be taken this evening. He proposed a compromise, an ultimatum at 8 a.m. tomorrow, expiring at noon. De Laudier replied that unless British bombers were ready to act at once, it would be better for French to delay, if possible, for some hours, attacks on German armies." Less than an hour later, at 10:30 p.m., Halifax rang up Bonnet. He urged the French to agree to the British compromise, an ultimatum to be presented in Berlin at 8 a.m. on the morrow, September 3rd, and to expire at noon. The French foreign minister not only would not agree, he protested to Halifax that the British insistence on such speed would create a deplorable impression. He demanded that London wait at least until noon before presenting any ultimatum to Hitler. Halifax: "It is impossible for His Majesty's government to wait until that hour. It is very doubtful whether the British government could hold the position here." The House of Commons was to meet at noon on Sunday, September 3rd, and it was obvious to Chamberlain and Halifax from the mood of Saturday evening's session that in order to survive they would have to give Parliament the answer it demanded. At 2 o'clock the next morning, the French ambassador in London, Corbin, warned Bonnet that the Chamberlain cabinet risked overthrow if it could not give Parliament definite word. Halifax, at the close of his telephone conversation with Bonnet, therefore informed him that Britain proposed to act on its own. The telegram of Halifax to Henderson reached Berlin about 4 a.m. The Foreign Secretary had sent Henderson two warning telegrams during the night. The first, dispatched at 11:50 p.m., read, "I may have to send you instructions tonight to make an immediate communication to the German government. Please be ready to act. You had better warn the Minister for Foreign Affairs that you may have to ask to see him at any moment." It would seem from this telegram that the British government had not quite made up its mind to go it alone, despite the French. But 35 minutes later, at 12:25 a.m. on September 3rd, Halifax wired Henderson, "You should ask for an appointment with Minister of Foreign Affairs at 9 a.m. Sunday morning. Instructions will follow." The decisive telegram from Halifax is dated 5 a.m. London time. Henderson, in his final report, says he received it at 4 a.m. The communication he was to make to the German government at 9 a.m. on Sunday, September 3rd, recalled the British note of September 1st, in which Great Britain declared its intention of fulfilling its obligations to Poland unless German troops were promptly withdrawn. "Although this communication," it continued, "was made more than 24 hours ago, no reply has been received, but German attacks upon Poland have been continued and intensified. I have accordingly the honor to inform you that unless not later than 11 a.m. British summer time, today, September 3rd, satisfactory assurances to the above effect have been given by the German government and have reached His Majesty's government in London, a state of war will exist between the two countries as from that hour." Halifax sent an additional wire, also dated 5 a.m., informing the ambassador that Coulondre would not make a similar communication to the German government until midday today, Sunday. He did not know what the French time limit would be, but thought it likely to be anything between 6 and 9 hours. In the early pre-dawn Sabbath hours, Henderson found it difficult to make contact with the Wilhelmstrasse. He was told that Ribbentrop would not be available at 9 a.m. on the Sunday, but that he could leave his communication with the official interpreter, Dr. Schmidt. On this historic day, Dr. Schmidt overslept, and, rushing to the Foreign Office by taxi, he saw the British ambassador already mounting the steps to the Foreign Office as he arrived. Ducking in by a side door, Schmidt managed to slip into Ribbentrop's office just at the stroke of 9 o'clock, in time to receive Henderson on the dot. "He came in looking very serious," Schmidt later recounted, "shook hands, but declined my invitation to be seated, remaining solemnly standing in the middle of the room. He read out the British ultimatum, handed Schmidt a copy, and bade him goodbye." The official interpreter hastened down the Wilhelmstrasse to the Chancellery with the document. Outside the Führer's office, he found most members of the cabinet and several ranking party officials collected about and anxiously awaiting his news. "When I entered the next room," Schmidt later recounted, "Hitler was sitting at his desk and Ribbentrop stood by the window. Both looked up expectantly as I came in. I stopped at some distance from Hitler's desk and then slowly translated the British ultimatum. When I finished, there was complete silence. Hitler sat immobile, gazing before him. After an interval which seemed an age, he turned to Ribbentrop, who had remained standing by the window. 'What now?' asked Hitler with a savage look, as though implying that his foreign minister had misled him about England's probable reaction. Ribbentrop answered quietly, 'I assume that the French will hand in a similar ultimatum within the hour.' His duty performed, Schmidt withdrew, stopping in the outer room to apprise the others of what had happened. They too were silent for a moment. Then, 'Goering turned to me and said, "If we lose this war, then God have mercy on us." Goebbels stood in a corner by himself, downcast and self-absorbed. Everywhere in the room I saw looks of grave concern. In the meantime, the inimitable Dollarus had been making his last amateurish effort to avoid the inevitable. At 8 a.m., Forbes had informed him of the British ultimatum which was being presented an hour later. He hastened out to Luftwaffe headquarters to see Goering and, according to his later account on the stand at Nuremberg, appealed to him to see to it that the German reply to the ultimatum was reasonable. He further suggested that the field marshal himself, before 11 o'clock, declare himself prepared to fly to London to negotiate. In his book, the Swedish businessman claims that Göring accepted the suggestion and telephoned to Hitler, who also agreed. There is no mention of this in the German papers, and Dr. Schmidt makes it clear that Göring, a few minutes after 9 o'clock, was not at his headquarters but at the Chancellery in the Führer's anteroom. At any rate, there is no doubt that the Swedish intermediary telephoned the British Foreign Office, not once, but twice. In the first call at 10:15 a.m., he took it upon himself to inform the British government that the German reply to its ultimatum was on the way, and that the Germans were still most anxious to satisfy the British government and to give satisfactory assurances not to violate the independence of Poland. He hoped London would consider Hitler's response in the most favorable light. Half an hour later, at 10:50 a.m., 10 minutes before the ultimatum ran out, Dolorès was once more on the long-distance line to the Foreign Office in London, this time to present his proposal that Göring, with Hitler's assent, fly immediately to the British capital. He did not realize that it was past time for such diplomatic antics, but he was soon made to. He was given an uncompromising answer from Halifax. His proposal could not be entertained. The German government had been asked a definite question, and presumably they would be sending a definite answer. His Majesty's government could not wait for further discussion with Göring. Whereupon Dolorès hung up and disappeared into the limbo of history until he reappeared, briefly, after the war at Nuremberg, and in his book, to recount his bizarre attempt to save world peace. He reappeared for a moment on September 24th when he met with Forbes at Oslo to ascertain, as he told the Nuremberg Tribunal before he was shut off, if there was still a possibility of averting a world war. He had meant well, he had striven for peace. For a few moments he had found himself in the center of the dazzling stage of world history. But as happened to almost everyone else, the confusion had been too great for him to see clearly. And, as he would admit at Nuremberg, he had at no time realized how much he had been taken in by the Germans. Shortly after 11 a.m., when the time limit in the British ultimatum had run out, Ribbentrop, who had declined to see the British ambassador 2 hours before, sent for him in order to hand him Germany's reply. The German government, it said, refused to receive or accept, let alone to fulfill, the British ultimatum. There followed a lengthy and shabby propaganda statement, obviously hastily concocted by Hitler and Ribbentrop during the intervening 2 hours. Designed to fool the easily fooled German people, it rehearsed all the lies with which we are now familiar, including the one about the Polish attacks on German territory, blamed Britain for all that had happened, and rejected attempts to force Germany to recall their forces which are lined up for the defense of the Reich. It declared, falsely, that Germany had accepted Mussolini's 11th-hour proposals for peace, and pointed out that Britain had rejected them. And after all of Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler, it accused the British government of preaching the destruction and extermination of the German people. So shoddy was this hastily prepared note that it ended with this sentence: "The intention, communicated to us by order of the British government by Mr. King Hall, of carrying the destruction of the German people even further than was done through the Versailles Treaty, is taken note of by us, and we shall therefore answer any aggressive action on the part of England with the same weapons and in the same form." The British government had, of course, never presented to Germany any intentions of Stephen King Hall, a retired naval officer, whose newsletters were a purely private venture. In fact, Henderson had protested to the Foreign Office against the circulation of King Hall's publication in Germany, and the British government had requested the editor to desist. Henderson read the document. "This completely false representation of events," as he later called it, and remarked, "It would be left to history to judge where the blame really lay." Ribbentrop retorted that history had already proved the facts. I was standing in the Wilhelmstrasse before the Chancellery about noon, when the loudspeakers suddenly announced that Great Britain had declared herself at war with Germany. In London, at 11:15 a.m., Halifax had handed the German chargé d'affaires a formal note stating that since no German assurances had been received by 11 a.m., "I have the honor to inform you that a state of war exists between the two countries as from 11 a.m. today, September 3rd. Some 250 people, no more, were standing there in the sun. They listened attentively to the announcement. When it was finished, there was not a murmur. They just stood there, stunned. It was difficult for them to comprehend that Hitler had led them into a world war. Soon, though it was the Sabbath, the newsboys were crying their extras. In fact, I noticed they were giving the papers away. I took one. It was the Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung, its headlines marching in large type across the page. British ultimatum turned down. England declares a state of war with Germany. British note demands withdrawal of our troops in the East. The Führer leaving today for the front. The headline over the official account read as though it had been dictated by Ribbentrop. German memorandum proves England's guilt. Proved, though it may have been, to a people as easily swindled as the Germans, it aroused no ill feelings toward the British during the day. When I passed the British embassy, from whose premises Henderson and his staff were moving to the Hotel Adlon around the corner, alone Schupo paced up and down before the building. He had nothing to do but saunter back and forth. The French held out a little longer. Bonnet played for time until the last moment, clinging stubbornly to the hope that Mussolini might still swing a deal with Hitler which would let France off the hook. He even pleaded with the Belgian ambassador to get King Leopold to use his influence with Mussolini to influence Hitler. All day Saturday, September 2nd, he argued with his own cabinet, as he did with the British, that he had promised Ciano to wait until noon of September 3rd for the German answer to the Anglo-French warning notes of September 1st, and that he could not go back on his word. He had, to be sure, given this assurance to the Italian foreign minister over the phone, but not until 9 o'clock on the evening of September 2nd. By that time, the Duce's proposal for a conference was as dead as stone, as Ciano had tried to tell him. And by that hour, too, the British were pleading with him to present a joint ultimatum to Berlin at midnight. Shortly before midnight on September 2nd, the French government finally reached a decision. At precisely midnight, Bonnet wired Coulondre at Berlin that in the morning he would forward the terms of a new démarche to be made at noon to the Wilhelmstrasse. But even after that, it will be remembered, Bonnet made a last-minute effort to keep France out of the war by proposing, during the night, to the Italians that they get Hitler to make a symbolic withdrawal from Poland. This he did at 10:20 a.m. on Sunday, September 3rd, 40 minutes before the British ultimatum ran out. The French ultimatum was similarly worded, except that in case of a negative reply, France declared that she would fulfill her obligations to Poland, which are known to the German government. Even at this final juncture, Bonnet held out against a formal declaration of war. In the official French Yellow Book, the text of the French ultimatum wired to Coulondre gives 5 p.m. as the time limit for the German response. But this was not the hour set in the original telegram. At 8:45 a.m., Ambassador Phipps had notified Halifax from Paris, "Bonnet tells me French time limit will only expire at 5 o'clock Monday morning, September 4th. That was the time given in Bonnet's telegram. Though it represented a concession wrung by Daladier early Sunday morning from the French General Staff, which had insisted on a full 48 hours from the time the ultimatum was given Berlin at noon, it still irritated the British government, whose displeasure was communicated to Paris in no uncertain terms during the forenoon. Premier Daladier, therefore, made one last appeal to the military. He called in General Costant of the General Staff at 11:30 a.m. and urged a shorter deadline. The general reluctantly agreed to move it up by 12 hours to 5 p.m. Thus it was that just as Coulondre was leaving the French embassy in Berlin for the Wilhelmstrasse, Bonnet got through to him on the telephone and instructed him to make the necessary change in the 0 hour. Ribbentrop was not available to the French ambassador at the noon hour. He was taking part in a little ceremony at the Chancellery, where the new Soviet ambassador, Alexander Shkvartsov, was being warmly received by the Führer, an occasion that lent a bizarre note to this historic Sabbath in Berlin. Coulondre, insistent on following the letter of his instructions to call at the Wilhelmstrasse at precisely 12 noon, was therefore received by Weizsäcker. To the ambassador's inquiry as to whether the state secretary was empowered to give a satisfactory answer to the French, Weizsäcker replied that he was not in a position to give him any kind of reply. There now followed at this solemn moment a minor diplomatic comedy. When Coulandre attempted to treat Weizsäcker's response as the negative German reply which he fully anticipated, and to hand to the State Secretary France's formal ultimatum, the latter declined to accept it. He suggested that the ambassador be good enough to be patient a little longer and see the foreign minister personally. Thus rebuffed, and not for the first time, Coulandre cooled his heels for nearly half an hour. At 12:30 p.m. he was conducted to the Chancellery to see Ribbentrop. Though the Nazi foreign minister knew what the ambassador's mission was, he could not let the opportunity, the very last such one, slip by without treating the French envoy to one of his customary prevarications of history. After remarking that Mussolini, in presenting his last-minute peace proposal, had emphasized that France approved it, Ribbentrop declared that Germany had informed the Duce yesterday that she also was prepared to agree to the proposal. Later in the day, Ribbentrop added, the Duce reported that his proposal had been wrecked by the intransigence of the British government. But Coulandre, over the past months, had heard enough of Ribbentrop's falsifications. After listening a little longer to the Nazi foreign minister, who had gone on to say that he would regret it if France followed Great Britain, and that Germany had no intention of attacking France, the ambassador got in the question he had come to ask. Did the foreign minister's remarks mean that the response of the German government to the French communication of September 1st was negative? Ja, replied Ribbentrop. The ambassador then handed the foreign minister France's ultimatum, prefacing it with a remark that, for the last time, he must emphasize the heavy responsibility of the Reich government in attacking Poland without a declaration of war, and in refusing the Anglo-French request that German troops be withdrawn. Then France will be the aggressor, Ribbentrop said. History will be the judge of that, Coulandre replied. On that Sunday in Berlin, all the participants in the final act of the drama seemed intent on calling upon the judgment of history. Although France was mobilizing an army which would have overwhelming superiority for the time being over the German forces in the West, it was Great Britain, whose army at the moment was negligible, which loomed in Hitler's feverish mind as the main enemy, and as the antagonist who was almost entirely responsible for the pass in which he found himself as September 3, 1939 began to wane and pass into history. This was made clear in the two grandiose proclamations which he issued during the afternoon to the German people and to the Army of the West. His bitter resentment and hysterical anger at the British burst forth. Great Britain, he said in an appeal to the German people, has for centuries pursued the aim of rendering the peoples of Europe defenseless against the British policy of world conquest, and claimed the right to attack on threadbare pretexts and destroy that European state which at the moment seemed most dangerous. We ourselves have been witnesses of the policy of encirclement carried on by Great Britain against Germany since before the war. The British war inciters oppressed the German people under the Versailles Diktat. Soldiers of the Western Army, Hitler said in an appeal to the troops who for many weeks could only face the French army, Great Britain has pursued the policy of Germany's encirclement. The British government, driven on by those warmongers whom we knew in the last war, have resolved to let fall their mask and to proclaim war on a threadbare pretext. There was not a word about France. In London, at 6 minutes past noon, Chamberlain addressed the House of Commons and informed it that Britain was now at war with Germany. Though Hitler on September 1st had forbidden listening to foreign broadcasts on the pain of death, we picked up in Berlin the words of the Prime Minister as quoted over the BBC. To those of us who had seen him risking his political life at Godesberg and Munich to appease Hitler, his words were poignant. This is a sad day for all of us, and to none is it sadder than to me. Everything that I have worked for, everything that I have believed in during my public life, has crashed into ruins. There is only one thing left for me to do, that is, to devote what strength and powers I have to forwarding the victory of the cause for which we have to sacrifice so much. I trust I may live to see the day when Hitlerism has been destroyed and a liberated Europe has been re-established. Chamberlain was fated not to live to see that day. He died, a broken man, though still a member of the cabinet, on November 9, 1940. In view of all that has been written about him in these pages, it seems only fitting to quote what was said of him by Churchill, whom he had excluded from the affairs of the British nation for so long, and who on May 10, 1940, succeeded him as Prime Minister. Paying tribute to his memory in the Commons on November 12, 1940, Churchill said, "It fell to Neville Chamberlain in one of the supreme crises of the world to be contradicted by events, to be disappointed in his hopes, and to be deceived and cheated by a wicked man. But what were these hopes in which he was disappointed? What were these wishes in which he was frustrated? What was that faith that was abused? They were surely among the most noble and benevolent instincts of the human heart, the love of peace, the toil for peace, the strife for peace, the pursuit of peace, even at great peril, and certainly in utter disdain of popularity or clamor." His diplomacy having failed to keep Britain and France out of the war, Hitler turned his attention during the afternoon of September 3rd to military matters. He issued Top Secret Directive No. 2 for the conduct of the war. Despite the Anglo-French war declarations, it said, "The German war objective remains for the time being the speedy and victorious conclusion of the operations against Poland. In the West, the opening of hostilities is to be left to the enemy. Against Britain, naval offensive operations are permitted." The Luftwaffe was not to attack even British naval forces unless the British opened similar attacks on German targets, and then only if prospects of success are particularly favorable. The conversion of the whole of German industry to war economy was ordered. At 9 o'clock in the evening, Hitler and Ribbentrop left Berlin in separate special trains for general headquarters in the East, but not before they had made two more diplomatic moves. Britain and France were now at war with Germany, but there were the two other great European powers whose support had made Hitler's venture possible to consider: Italy, the ally, which had reneged at the last moment, and Soviet Russia, which, though distrusted by the Nazi dictator, had obliged him by making his gamble on war seem worth the taking. Just before leaving the capital, Hitler got off another letter to Mussolini. It was dispatched by wire at 8:51 p.m., 9 minutes before the Führer's special train pulled out of the station. Though not entirely frank nor devoid of deceit, it gives the best picture we shall probably ever have of the mind of Adolf Hitler as he set out for the first time from the darkened capital of the Third Reich to assume his role as supreme German warlord. It is among the captured Nazi papers. "Duce, I must first thank you for your last attempt at mediation. I would have been ready to accept, but only on condition that some possibility could have been found to give me certain guarantees that the conference would be successful. For the German troops have been engaged for 2 days in an extraordinarily rapid advance into Poland. It would have been impossible to allow blood which was there sacrificed to be squandered through diplomatic intrigue. Nevertheless, I believe that a way could have been found if England had not been determined from the outset to let it come to war in any case. I did not yield to England's threats because, Duce, I no longer believe that peace could have been maintained for more than 6 months, or, shall we say, a year. In these circumstances, I considered that the present moment was, in spite of everything, more suitable for making a stand. The Polish army will collapse in a very short time. Whether it would have been possible to achieve this quick success in another year or two is, I must say, very doubtful, in my opinion. England and France would have gone on arming their allies to such an extent that the decisive technical superiority of the German Wehrmacht could not have been in evidence in the same way. I am aware, Duce, that the struggle in which I am engaging is a struggle for life and death. But I am also aware that such a struggle cannot in the end be avoided, and that the moment for resistance must be chosen with icy deliberation, so that the likelihood of success is assured. And in this success, Duce, my faith is as firm as a rock." Next came words of warning to Mussolini. "You kindly assured me recently that you believe you can help in some fields. I accept this in advance with sincere thanks. But I also believe that, even if we now march down separate paths, destiny will yet bind us one to the other. If National Socialist Germany were to be destroyed by the Western democracies, Fascist Italy also would face a hard future. I personally was always aware that the futures of our two regimes were bound up, and I know that you, Duce, are of exactly the same opinion. After recounting the initial German victories in Poland, Hitler concluded, "In the West I shall remain on the defensive. France can shed her blood there first. The moment will then come when we can pit ourselves there also against the enemy with the whole strength of the nation. Please accept once more my thanks, Duce, for all the support you have given me in the past, and which I ask you not to refuse me in the future, either. Adolf Hitler." Hitler's disappointment that Italy did not honor her word, even after Britain and France had honored theirs by declaring war on this day, was kept under tight control. A friendly Italy, even though non-belligerent, could still be helpful to him. But even more helpful could be Russia. Already on the first day of the German attack on Poland, the Soviet government, as the secret Nazi papers would later reveal, had rendered the German Luftwaffe a signal service. Very early on that morning, the chief of the General Staff of the Air Force, General Hans Jeschenek, had rung up the German embassy in Moscow to say that in order to give his pilots navigational aid in the bombing of Poland, urgent navigation tests, he called it, he would appreciate it if the Russian radio station at Minsk would continually identify itself. By afternoon, Ambassador von der Schulenburg was able to inform Berlin that the Soviet government was prepared to meet your wishes. The Russians agreed to introduce a station identification as often as possible in the programs over their transmitter, and to extend the broadcasting time of the Minsk station by 2 hours, so as to aid the German flyers late at night. But as they prepared to leave Berlin late on September 3rd, Hitler and Ribbentrop had in mind much more substantial Russian military help for their conquest of Poland. At 6:50 p.m., Ribbentrop got off a most urgent telegram to the embassy in Moscow. It was marked Top Secret and began, "Exclusive for the ambassador, for the head of mission or his representative personally. Special security handling, to be decoded by himself. Most secret." In the greatest of secrecy, the Germans invited the Soviet Union to join in the attack on Poland. "We definitely expect to have beaten the Polish army decisively in a few weeks. We should then keep the territory that was fixed at Moscow as a German sphere of interest under military occupation. We should naturally, however, for military reasons, have to continue to take action against such Polish military forces as are at that time located in the Polish territory belonging to the Russian sphere of interest. Please discuss this at once with Molotov and see if the Soviet Union does not consider it desirable for Russian forces to move at the proper time against Polish forces in the Russian sphere of interest, and for their part to occupy this territory. In our estimation, this would be not only a relief for us, but also be in the sense of the Moscow agreements and in the Soviet interest as well." That such a cynical move by the Soviet Union would be a relief to Hitler and Ribbentrop is obvious. It would not only avoid misunderstandings and friction between the Germans and the Russians in dividing up the spoils, but would take some of the onus of the Nazi aggression in Poland off Germany and place it on the Soviet Union. If they shared the booty, why should they not share the blame? The most gloomy German of any consequence in Berlin that Sunday noon, after it became known that Britain was in the war, was Grand Admiral Erich Raeder, Commander-in-Chief of the German Navy. For him, the war had come 4 or 5 years too soon. By 1944-45, the Navy's Z-plan would have been completed, giving Germany a sizable fleet with which to confront the British. But this was September 3, 1939. And Raeder knew, even if Hitler wouldn't listen to him, that he had neither the surface ships nor even the submarines to wage effective war against Great Britain. Confiding to his diary, the Admiral wrote, "Today the war against France and England broke out, the war which, according to the Führer's previous assertions, we had no need to expect before 1944. The Führer believed up to the last minute that it could be avoided, even if this meant postponing a final settlement of the Polish question. As far as the Navy is concerned, obviously, it is in no way very adequately equipped for the great struggle with Great Britain. The submarine arm is still much too weak to have any decisive effect on the war. The surface forces, moreover, are so inferior in number and strength to those of the British fleet that, even at full strength, they can do no more than show that they know how to die gallantly." Nevertheless, at 9 p.m., on September 3, 1939, at the moment Hitler was departing Berlin, the German Navy struck. Without warning, the submarine U-30 torpedoed and sank the British liner Athenia some 200 miles west of the Hebrides as it was en route from Liverpool to Montreal with 1,400 passengers, of whom 112, including 28 Americans, lost their lives. World War II had begun. Book 4. War. Early Victories and the Turning Point. Chapter 18. The Fall of Poland. At 10 o'clock on the morning of September 5, 1939, General Halder had a talk with General von Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief of the German army, and General von Bock, who led Army Group North. After sizing up the situation as it looked to them at the beginning of the fifth day of the German attack on Poland, they agreed, as Halder wrote in his diary, that the enemy is practically beaten. By the evening of the previous day, the battle for the corridor had ended with the junction of General von Kluge's 4th Army pushing eastward from Pomerania and General von Kückler's 3rd Army driving westward from East Prussia. It was in this battle that General Heinz Guderian first made a name for himself with his tanks. At one point, racing east across the corridor, they had been counterattacked by the Pomorska Brigade of cavalry, and this writer, coming upon the scene a few days later, saw the sickening evidence of the carnage. It was symbolic of the brief Polish campaign. Horses against tanks. The cavalryman's long lance against the tank's long cannon. Brave and valiant and foolhardy though they were, the Poles were simply overwhelmed by the German onslaught. This was their, and the world's, first experience of the Blitzkrieg. The sudden surprise attack, the fighter planes and bombers roaring overhead, reconnoitering, attacking, spreading flame and terror, the Stukas screaming as they dove, the tanks, whole divisions of them, breaking through and thrusting forward 30 or 40 miles in a day, self-propelled, rapid-firing heavy guns rolling 40 miles an hour down even the rutty Polish roads, the incredible speed of even the infantry, of the whole vast army of 1.5 million men on motorized wheels, directed and coordinated through a maze of electronic communications consisting of intricate radio, telephone, and telegraphic networks. This was a monstrous mechanized juggernaut such as the earth had never seen. Within 48 hours, the Polish Air Force was destroyed, most of its 500 first-line planes having been blown up by German bombing on their home airfields before they could take off. Installations were burned and most of the ground crews were killed or wounded. Krakow, the second city of Poland, fell on September 6th. That night, the Polish government fled from Warsaw to Lublin. The next day, Halder busied himself with plans to begin transferring troops to the Western Front, though he could detect no activity there. On the afternoon of September 8th, the 4th Panzer Division reached the outskirts of the Polish capital, while directly south of the city, rolling up from Silesia and Slovakia, Reichenau's 10th Army captured Kielce, and Liszt's 14th Army arrived at Sandomierz, at the junction of the Vistula and San rivers. In 1 week, the Polish army had been vanquished. Most of its 35 divisions, all that there had been time to mobilize, had been either shattered or caught in a vast pincers movement that closed in around Warsaw. There now remained for the Germans the second phase, tightening the noose around the dazed and disorganized Polish units which were surrounded and destroying them, and completing a second and larger pincers movement 100 miles to the east, which would trap the remaining Polish formations west of Brest-Litovsk and the River Bug. This phase began September 9th and ended on September 17th. The left wing of Bock's Army Group North, headed for Brest-Litovsk, which Guderian's 19th Corps reached on the 14th and captured 2 days later. On September 17th, it met patrols of Liszt's 14th Army, 50 miles south of Brest-Litovsk, at Wlodowa, closing the second great pincers there. The counterattack, as Guderian later observed, had come to a definite conclusion on September 17th. All Polish forces, except for a handful on the Russian border, were surrounded. Pockets of Polish troops in the Warsaw Triangle and farther west near Posen held out valiantly, but they were doomed. The Polish government, or what was left of it, after being unceasingly bombed and strafed by the Luftwaffe, reached a village on the Romanian frontier on the 15th. For it and the proud nation, all was over, except the dying in the ranks of the units which still, with incredible fortitude, held out. It was now time for the Russians to move in on the stricken country to grab a share of the spoils. The Russians invade Poland. The Kremlin in Moscow, like every other seat of government, had been taken by surprise at the rapidity with which the German armies hurtled through Poland. On September 5th, Molotov, in giving a formal written reply to the Nazi suggestion that Russia attack Poland from the east, stated that this would be done at a suitable time, but that this time has not yet come. He thought that excessive haste might injure the Soviet cause, but he insisted that even though the Germans got there first, they must scrupulously observe the line of demarcation in Poland agreed upon in the secret clauses of the Nazi-Soviet pact. Russian suspicion of the Germans was already evident. So was the feeling in the Kremlin that the German conquest of Poland might take quite a long time. But shortly after midnight of September 8th, after a German armored division had reached the outskirts of Warsaw, Ribbentrop wired urgent a top-secret message to Schulenburg in Moscow, stating that operations in Poland were progressing even beyond our expectations, and that in these circumstances Germany would like to know the military intentions of the Soviet government. By 4:10 p.m. the next day, Molotov had replied that Russia would move militarily within the next few days. Earlier in the day, the Soviet Foreign Commissar had officially congratulated the Germans on the entry of German troops into Warsaw. On September 10th, Molotov and Ambassador von der Schulenburg got into a fine snafu. After declaring that the Soviet government had been taken completely by surprise by the unexpectedly rapid German military successes, and that the Soviet Union was consequently in a difficult situation, the Foreign Commissar touched on the excuse which the Kremlin would have to give for its own aggression in Poland. This was, as Schulenburg wired Berlin, most urgent and top secret. That Poland was falling apart, and that it was necessary for the Soviet Union, in consequence, to come to the aid of the Ukrainians and the White Russians threatened by Germany. This argument, said Molotov, was necessary to make the intervention of the Soviet Union plausible to the masses, and at the same time avoid giving the Soviet Union the appearance of an aggressor. Furthermore, Molotov complained that General von Brauchitsch had just been quoted by DNB as saying that military action was no longer necessary on the German eastern border. If that were so, if the war was over, Russia, said Molotov, could not start a new war. He was very displeased about the whole situation. To further complicate matters, he summoned Schulenburg to the Kremlin on September 14th, and after informing him that the Red Army would march sooner than they had anticipated, demanded to know when Warsaw would fall. In order to justify their move, the Russians must wait on the capture of the Polish capital. The Commissar had raised some embarrassing questions. When would Warsaw fall? How did the Germans like being blamed for Russian intervention? On the evening of September 15th, Ribbentrop dispatched a most urgent, a top-secret message to Molotov through the German ambassador, answering them. Warsaw, he said, would be occupied in the next few days. Germany would welcome the Soviet military operation now. As to the Russian excuse blaming Germany for it, this was out of the question, contrary to the true German intentions, would be in contradiction to the arrangements made in Moscow, and finally would make the two states appear as enemies before the whole world. He ended by asking the Soviet government to set the day and the hour for their attack on Poland. This was done the next evening, and two dispatches of Schulenburg, which are among the captured German papers, telling how it was done, give a revealing picture of the Kremlin's deceit. I saw Molotov at 6 p.m., Schulenburg wired on September 16th. Molotov declared that military intervention by the Soviet Union was imminent, perhaps even tomorrow or the day after. Stalin was at present in consultation with the military leaders. Molotov added that the Soviet government intended to justify its procedure as follows. The Polish state had disintegrated and no longer existed. Therefore, all agreements concluded with Poland were void. Third powers might try to profit by the chaos which had arisen. The Soviet government considered itself obligated to intervene to protect its Ukrainian and White Russian brothers and make it possible for these unfortunate people to work in peace. Since Germany could be the only possible third power in question, Schulenburg objected. Molotov conceded that the proposed argument of the Soviet government contained a note that was jarring to German sensibilities, but asked us, in view of the difficult situation of the Soviet government, not to stumble over this piece of straw. The Soviet government unfortunately saw no possibility of any other motivation, since the Soviet Union had heretofore not bothered about the plight of its minorities in Poland, and had to justify abroad, in some way or other, its present intervention. At 5:20 p.m. on September 17th, Schulenburg got off another most urgent and top-secret wire to Berlin. Stalin received me at 2 o'clock and declared that the Red Army would cross the Soviet border at 6 o'clock. Soviet planes would begin today to bomb the district east of Lvov, Lemberg. When Schulenburg objected to 3 points in the Soviet communiqué, the Russian dictator, with the utmost readiness, altered the text. Thus it was that on the shabby pretext that because Poland had ceased to exist and therefore the Polish-Soviet non-aggression pact had also ceased to exist, and because it was necessary to protect its own interests and those of the Ukrainian and White Russian minorities, the Soviet Union trampled over a prostrate Poland beginning on the morning of September 17th. To add insult to injury, the Polish ambassador in Moscow was informed that Russia would maintain strict neutrality in the Polish conflict. The next day, September 18th, Soviet troops met the Germans at Brest-Litovsk, where exactly 21 years before a newborn Bolshevik government had gone back on its country's ties with the Western Allies and had received from the German army and accepted separate peace terms of great harshness. And yet, though they were now accomplices of Nazi Germany in wiping ancient Poland off the map, the Russians were at once distrustful of their new comrades. At his meeting with the German ambassador on the eve of the Soviet aggression, Stalin had expressed his doubts, as Schulenburg duly notified Berlin, whether the German high command would stand by the Moscow agreements and withdraw to the line that had been agreed upon. The ambassador tried to reassure him, but apparently with no great success. In view of Stalin's well-known attitude of mistrust, Schulenburg wired Berlin, I would be gratified if I were authorized to make a further declaration of such a nature as to remove his last doubts. The next day, September 19th, Ribbentrop telegraphed the ambassador, authorizing him to tell Stalin that the agreements which I made at Moscow will, of course, be kept, and that they are regarded by us as the foundation stone of the new friendly relations between Germany and the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, friction between the two unnatural partners continued. On September 17th, there was disagreement over the text of a joint communiqué which would justify the Russo-German destruction of Poland. Stalin objected to the German version because it presented the facts all too frankly. Whereupon he wrote out his own version, a masterpiece of subterfuge, and forced the Germans to accept it. It stated that the joint aim of Germany and Russia was to restore peace and order in Poland, which has been destroyed by the disintegration of the Polish state, and to help the Polish people to establish new conditions for its political life. For cynicism, Hitler had met his match in Stalin. At first, both dictators seemed to have considered setting up a rump Polish state on the order of Napoleon's Grand Duchy of Warsaw in order to mollify world public opinion. But on September 19th, Molotov disclosed that the Bolsheviks were having second thoughts on that. After angrily protesting to Schulenburg that the German generals were disregarding the Moscow agreement by trying to grab territory that should go to Russia, he came to the main point. Molotov hinted, Schulenburg wired Berlin, that the original inclination entertained by the Soviet government and Stalin personally to permit the existence of a residual Poland had given way to the inclination to partition Poland along the Pisa-Narew-Wistula-San line. The Soviet government wishes to commence negotiations on this matter at once. Thus, the initiative to partition Poland completely, to deny the Polish people any independent existence of their own whatsoever, came from the Russians. But the Germans did not need much urging to agree. On September 23rd, Ribbentrop wired Schulenburg, instructing him to tell Molotov that the Russian idea of a borderline along the well-known Four Rivers line coincides with the view of the Reich government. He proposed to again fly to Moscow to work out the details of that, as well as of the definitive structure of the Polish area. Stalin now took personal charge of the negotiations, and his German allies learned, as his British and American allies later would also learn, what a tough, cynical, and opportunistic bargainer he was. The Soviet dictator summoned Schulenburg to the Kremlin at 8 p.m. on September 25th, and the ambassador's dispatch later that evening warned Berlin of some stern realities and of some chickens that were coming home to roost.